Welcome to another episode of Ed Luminaries with Alejandra Zertuche, CEO of Enflux, who brings you powerful educator perspectives hailing from all walks of life. Get inspired and obtain great takeaways that you can apply to help set your students up for success. Sometimes all it takes is to hear how innovative educators approach similar problems and overcome obstacles to support breakthrough academic success.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Alejandra Zertuche, and you're listening to the Ed Luminaries podcast, where we talk with educational leaders to find out how they're thinking and working creatively to drive student success. In today's episode, The Importance of Data Literacy in Higher Education, we will explore why data literacy is crucial for higher ed institutions and how it impacts decision-making. Today, we are joined by Ashley Parent, an expert in the field of data literacy in higher ed. Ashley brings a wealth of experience and knowledge to our discussion. Having worked with the University Analytics and Institutional Research Department at the University of Arizona for over 8 years, she is passionate about promoting data literacy and helping higher ed institutions make informed decisions through the effective use of data. We are thrilled to have her here today to share her insights on the importance of data literacy in higher ed. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. So happy to be here.
Our pleasure. I'm really excited to get started and talk about data literacy. But before we do, I want the listeners to have a chance to learn more about you. Who's Ashley? What inspired Ashley to pursue a career in data and institutional research?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is a great question. You know, I think when I'm talking to potential or, you know, applicants to the work, to our department and people that are interested in getting into the field, I think people have this idea that there's like a straight path of how to get into institutional research. And I find that it's much more circuitous for people. And I think sometimes through life experience and different types of opportunities, people kind of find themselves there. And once they get there, they realize what a dynamic and evolving and interesting field it is to be a part of within higher ed. So I started my career working in various sort of like business administration type roles for university. And throughout that time, I was also going to school. And so while I was going to school, I thought I wanted to become a therapist. So empathy has always been one of my strengths. I love working with people. I love helping people. And I always thought that that would take shape in kind of a more traditional way. But as I was working in business administration roles, eventually I found myself in an accounting role where I was one of my primary tasks was to support faculty in understanding the monthly expenses that were hitting their research project accounts. And the process that had been defined for this was incredibly archaic. It involved me printing out reams and reams and reams of paper with reports, and I would highlight the faculty's name, you know, staple it, walk it to their office. And it just seemed, it seemed like a silly. You know, I don't know if anyone was ever looking at it. It took a huge chunk of time, and it seemed silly. So at the same time, a self-service business intelligence tool was being released to the institution, to our campus. And so this was a product that internally we called UAccess Analytics, but it was actually behind the scenes an Oracle tool. So now it's gone through several iterations, but now the tool is known as Oracle Analytics Server. And I just fell in love with that tool and quickly realized how much potential and power, you know, if you were able to learn how to harness the data and understand the data, there was incredible potential. So in this position where I was working as an accountant, I built a set of reports for faculty, where I was really thinking about the faculty first in terms of the design for the tool and set it up so that we just kind of had this automatic sending of reports to those individuals wrapped around with definitions of the data and expectation of what they were supposed to do. And And I think that that was really the first tool of its kind to be developed on our campus, one that was really like starting with the user first. So that was my entry point. And, you know, just this idea of harnessing technology to help make people's day-to-day lives easier was my entry point. So through that, you know, I was finishing my schooling, psychology, social work, therapy. But I quickly realized, you know, that wasn't actually the right path. And then that's when I looked into kind of an entry-level position with our analytics team. And then I've been there ever since.
Wow, that's an amazing journey. From accounting to institutional research and help. I mean, you're still helping faculty, but it's a different yes. type of data. What was the timeline? Around what year was it? And what was the name of the Oracle tool that you were
yeah,
utilizing?
Yeah, absolutely. So most folks probably know, many folks might be familiar with a tool called Oracle Business Intelligence Enterprise Edition, OBIEE. So that was kind of the first iteration of the tool. Now that same tool is in the cloud and the product is Oracle Analytics Server, but internal to our campus, we branded it as UAccess Analytics. So okay. So we have that reporting tool internally. We also use Tableau for externally facing public types of report. That tool was released to campus probably about 12 years ago. And I've been with the department that I'm with now, University Analytics and Institutional Research, for about 7 years, going on 8.
That's wonderful. And what are some of the key initiatives that you and your team are working on currently? Are you still utilizing, you mentioned that Oracle tool, but it went to the cloud mm-hmm. and you have Tableau. So the Oracle tool is internal, Tableau is external.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of key initiatives, data literacy has been at the forefront for probably the last 5 years. When I joined the team, nobody was thinking about data literacy. Nobody was really thinking about the end user. And so when I joined the team, I'm just like, whoa, you know, I saw so many opportunities to enhance what we were doing so that hopefully enhance kind of like the context, definitions, you know, titles, it basically kind of like all the wraparound context around what we were doing. So the people were able, our users, end users were able to fully understand what they had access to and then build confidence in that data and be able to better leverage it. So data literacy is a key initiative, continues to be a key initiative. Under our chief data officer, I would say that he's been pretty visionary in terms of making this a priority for our team. We, just to give a little bit more context about our team, we have about 50 people within our department, which is incredibly unusual for yeah. an IR type of office. But one thing to keep in mind is we do have our systems and security team in-house. We also have our data warehouse, our data engineers in-house, plus all of our data analysts and business intelligence developers. Plus, we have a customer experience and support team, which encompasses training, communications, data visualization, data literacy, and project management. So we've got a big team, and we have a lot of resources to put towards data literacy. So I just want to make that very clear. You know, we're pretty unique, and we have our CDO, we have to thank for that, because he's really been visionary in making that, you know, putting the resources behind that to make it really successful. So with data literacy, we are always looking for new opportunities and ways to engage our campus. In a lot of ways, I think that building data literacy is never ending. The bar is constantly being raised. And by that, I mean that as we provide better and more meaningful and more advanced analytics to our leadership, it kind of raises the bar for their understanding of what's available and what they want. And so when they have what they want and what they need, then everybody else kind of has to catch up, you know, to be able to speak the same language. So that's always like, I think that that's advancing at a rate that's really, really, really quick. But then we also have kind of the foundation of our more like everyday user who might not have much experience with institutional data, they might be sort of the only data person on their team, you know, quote unquote data person. And so we're kind of trying to support both populations. We want to make sure that our entry level users, colleagues, they have sort of all of the foundational kinds of needs in place so that they can get their job done. But we also have to make sure that our leadership has what they need, and we're always sort of like advancing to help raise the bar and answer kind of these like ever increasingly complex questions that are being asked. So, I have so much to say,
wonderful. I was going to say, you know, I have seen that throughout different programs, and it's almost like people didn't know they were starving for insights. But as soon as you show them some of those insights, they're like, oh my God, the sky is the limit. Give me more. I have all of these questions that I want to answer, which is great because it replaces like that just saying, oh, my intuition tells me that we should do this. And they, instead of doing that, I have seen the shift of, oh, let me contact IR or let me contact Ashley to see if they have data about this, because this is my question. And that's fabulous. Once you start seeing that, is because you're accomplishing your goal. You've converted them to be more data literate. And for those, I was going to ask you, Ashley, like for those that are not familiarized with the terminology, can you describe what data literacy means and what it entails?
Absolutely. There's many, many excellent resources that are available to support data literacy and kind of build the tools that are around it. But at its most basic, data literacy can be defined as the ability to read, work with, analyze, and argue with data, regardless of your role, skill level, or the tools that you use.
That's a wonderful definition.
That comes straight from the Data Literacy Project. So if folks have interest in data literacy and they're not sure where to start, that is an excellent resource, Data Literacy Project.
That's a wonderful definition. And what component of that definition do you think is the hardest for users?
this is my psychology side coming out. Are you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
A little bit. Not an expert.
Yeah, that's okay. So, you know, for folks listening to the podcast today, think back to Psych 101. And at some point you were probably presented with this triangle diagram where it sort of talked about kind of like, you know, your foundation of needs. And basically like, you know, at the bottom of this triangle are your most basic needs: sleep, food, water. Once those have been satisfied, you can kind of like build into higher level of needs, you know, education, love. I mean, it just gets kind of like things that are nice to have and you do need, but you can't really focus on those things until you have the foundation set. So, when I think about that definition of data literacy as the ability to read, work with, analyze, and argue, I think we've done a tremendous amount of work to support data literacy. And I still think we're working on the ability to read with our population. We have about 13,000 employees at the University of Arizona, 4,200 of which have some level of provisioning for our internal business intelligence tool or our analytics tool. 4,200 people. And that's a lot. And, you know, even within that number, there's an incredible amount of turnover. People are moving positions, they're leaving the institution, they're coming into the institution. So in some ways, I think the hardest thing is just getting everybody kind of up to the level of even being able to read a table, understand kind of like basic, you know, really basic foundational topics. Even this idea, you know, for those of you who are in this field, just the idea of like understanding a student count is very complicated. How do you define a student? There are many ways. So that's the part that I kind of keep coming back to is I find that to be very difficult, because sometimes I'm like, gosh, we've done so much work in this space. We must be doing an excellent job. Let's move on. And then I find, you know, I keep getting questions about, you know, kind of these foundational themes. And I'm like, okay, we have to do more. So
That's a great way of describing data literacy because it's the foundation, right? The ability to read. And then the definition of some of the terminology that you might be using internally, because language can change between institutions. What you consider a full-time student might be different than another university considers a full-time student. So how do you provide, is that part of your initiative of data literacy, providing them with definitions?
Yes. That is a huge area of focus for us. In a perfect world, we would have software that would serve as a data dictionary to encompass all of the institutional data that's being pulled into our warehouse and being reported off of. We're not there yet. That's something that is on our roadmap for the future, but we're not there yet. So in the meantime, what do we do? In the meantime, every single tool, every single white paper, every single dashboard that's developed and shared with campus, all of it, a requirement, all of it has to be combined with a reference guide or some sort of like dictionary that's just specific to that set of tools. That was not always a requirement. That is something that is a must now. It's not even a question. And everybody knows that. It's just built into what we do. And I think that's made a tremendous amount of difference, but it's still not enough. So sometimes there are specific topics that we'll send memos to campus about and end up including them as like an FAQ on our website. We refer to them often. You know, some of those key questions that just get asked often, you know, you mentioned FTE a moment ago. That is something that there's a lot of opaqueness around. And there's different ways to define it. So that's something we've got a memo about. But one of the ones that we've done most recently that I think has been really effective is this idea of like, within the University of Arizona, we have a couple different constructs for defining race and ethnicity. And they're kind of named similarly. We've got three. So one adheres to the current definition of IPEDS. Hopefully folks are familiar with IPEDS. I think the acronym is Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. Yes. If you work in our field and you haven't heard about IPEDS yet, you will someday. So we've got current IPEDS race ethnicity. We've got pre-2010 race ethnicity because there's some differences. And then most recently, we have developed one that we're calling inclusive race ethnicity. And that actually different than the IPEDS definitions where individuals are essentially kind of forced into one category, even if they identify in different ways. What inclusive race ethnicity does is it allows for us to fully reflect someone's complete identity using flags instead of like pushing people into one category. So we've got these three different approaches. You know, there's different reasons to use each of them. There's different pros and cons. There's, you know, different audiences that might benefit. And so we put together a really comprehensive set of FAQs that lives on our website. It's publicly available, but it's also something that we reference all the time. And I think campus has found, you know, while they find the data definitions really helpful, FAQs that kind of put those definitions into context and gives them advice about when and why and where to use a particular type of reporting construct, I think can be really helpful as well. And you know, in the field of IR, race ethnicity, you know, reporting out by demographic is a huge, huge aspect of what we do.
Providing data definitions and knowledge base or FAQ is extremely helpful because I have seen faculty or administrators make the wrong inferences based on the data. So have you noticed that? Have you ever encountered a case where someone wrote a paper, wrote an email and making assumptions about the numbers and everything else without considering the definitions and the assumptions were completely wrong?
Yes. yes, I have seen that happen. Gosh. Okay, so you had mentioned about initiatives earlier, and you know, unfortunately, the scenario that you just mentioned, it happens. You know, I think that it's really, really hard to present data in such a way that the consumer of that information is going to interpret it in the same way that you're intending. I mean, often there's a gap, and it takes a lot of skill to kind of like close that gap. One of the things that we've been focused on over the last several years is a tool that we've developed called Arizona Profiles. This lives within UXS Analytics, and essentially it has been developed for our leadership at different levels, you know, from all the way at the top to a college dean, to an assistant director, I mean, any level of leadership. But basically the idea is that we're coming from the assumption that these individuals don't have a lot of time or resources to invest in fully understanding all the context around any key metric that they might be asked for. So we've developed a tool that presents like the key metrics that are being requested at all levels of the institution. We've developed a dashboard that's incredibly easy to use, hopefully. It's aggregated information, and it presents across all of the different pillars of data that we report on. So we've got data about our workforce, our students, our finances, our sponsored research, our physical space. And we've designed it in such a way that there are institutionally agreed upon definitions that are built into every single metric. You can go to the dashboard. It will present information in a very sort of high level, easy to understand format. And you can run it at the university level. You can easily run it at the college level or your own particular unit. And all of those dashboards have context around it. All of them have definitions. And so for our leadership, if they're looking for a quick number, if they need to kind of get, you know, sanity, maybe they got a number from someone they're working with and they kind of want to quickly sanity check it against what the institutionally defined approach is, they have access to this tool now. Whereas before, we really didn't have any tools that were developed with leadership in mind. I mean, as a leader, the learning curve was steep. So, you know, in terms of accessing institutional data points, so individuals really had to work with their business office, but there's no reason that they should have to do that as long as there's good tools in place. So we've found that has been a great starting point for our leadership. It's not going to answer all the questions, but at least gives us kind of like an apples to apples starting point for conversations.
It seems like you created dashboards that are easy to consume, meaning like they're basic questions or questions that they have frequently, because you don't want them to be like a data scientist and go into the dashboards and download data and try to make their own inferences about their question or the way they're trying to answer something. I think that's a great approach because you can also in some way control what they're using, meaning you're giving, not that you want to control the insights, but you're providing them with insights that you make sure they understand what they mean.
Yeah, and they've been vetted. You know, our institution takes a pretty democratic approach to data access. So as long as you have a business purpose for accessing particular types of information, you can, and you can see for the whole institution. And sometimes, you know, let's say I'm a dean for a college, I might have somebody on my team who is a data scientist and really does want to dig into sort of all of the weeds, but that person might be coming up with their own definition for a particular metric. And me as the dean, you know, I don't necessarily understand, I'm not necessarily sure kind of how this benchmarks against what is expected in terms of that metric. You know, sometimes there are reasons to deviate from an institutionally defined approach, but it's important for our leaders to know that too. Like, okay, you know, my data scientist thinks that this is kind of where we sit with this particular figure. But, you know, for me to have confidence or kind of understand where it fits in the bigger picture, this tool gives them access to that as well.
That is wonderful because anyone has the power of running their own analysis, but we all know that if you torture the data enough, it will confess. And it will confess to what you want to hear, right?
Absolutely.
You want to be careful with that so that they consider that. So talking about that, what are some of the ethical considerations that faculty, administrators, leaders, even data scientists need to keep in mind when they're looking at the data?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, at its core, I think one of the ethical principles that I really encourage my team to keep in mind is just this idea of every single number that we're looking at represents a human and represents, you know, different circumstances, different life situations. And so I think it's really easy to kind of get lost in the data itself and forget that everything, most of what we're looking at represents humans, often our students that we're working to support. So that I think it's really important to keep that in mind. The data that we're putting out has real world implications. So beyond that, one of the ethical considerations that I think we deal with even more frequently is just this idea of privacy. I think data privacy is a really hot topic, and it's one that's evolving. So as I had mentioned before, the self-service tool that we have available to on our campus has been around for about 12 years. And a lot has happened in the last 12 years. And data is a living organism. You know, it's something that grows and changes over time. And in a lot of ways needs to evolve to meet the changing needs of the people and institutions that it represents. So what does that mean? That means that some of the data that has been available for a long time, now steps are being taken to maybe make that a little bit less accessible at the individual level. And one thing that I'm talking about specifically would be just this idea of demographics. From a privacy standpoint, there's sort of some changing ideas around what type of demographic information is being made available at the individual level. Still available at the aggregate level, so we can still kind of get our totals and understand what the bigger picture looks like. But from a privacy standpoint, there is interest in moving away from being able to, you know, look up one individual student and get sort of this, a lot of demographic detail about that person. And that's changed, you know, that's changed over time. That has evolved. One thing that we run into, though, as we start to look at focusing more on kind of an aggregate picture around different types of demographic data, is we still have to be really sensitive to small population sizes. We, for example, you know, we might be presenting the racial and ethnic distribution of a particular major. And one major, English, let's say, has many, 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 many students. Maybe we're looking at another department or another academic program that's just not as popular. There's not as many students, and maybe we only have 5 or 6 individuals. Well, from a privacy standpoint, it's going to be a lot harder to discern individual identity and demographic mm-hmm. information at a student level for a larger department. But for the smaller department, they still need to understand the diversity of their program and try and figure out, you know, do they need different programming in place to support various populations and attract various groups to their unit. Anyway, all that's to say, both departments need information, but the smaller the cell size gets, the harder it is to provide that detail without
anonymizing the data. Yeah,
exactly. So that is an ethical challenge that we're trying to figure out, kind of like, what are our internal standards around? What are our external standards? And we kind of have a different approaches depending on the audience and like the level of provisioning and access that an individual already has. But that's something that we are actively working on.
That's an excellent point of view. When I asked the question, I wasn't even thinking about that, the sample size. Like, we need to be careful with that and privacy, because if it's a small group of people and we're providing statistics about them, it might be really easy to identify the individuals, even if you're not providing names, based on demographics, based on different things.
Absolutely.
So that's an excellent point. So Ashley, as data literacy is extremely important, because the main goal is for people to make better decisions, to be empowered to make better decisions. Do you have any good examples? I'm sure you have a lot of great examples, but what would be an example where someone was empowered with data literacy and was able to improve decision making?
That's a great question.
We have seen programs where they were able to, for instance, improve graduation on time or understand what group of students needed different services so that they could be successful and stay engaged. So I was wondering, it's from, because I know that the decision making might be happening more at the different programs within the leaders. And sometimes I've seen that they fail to provide that those achievements back into the institutional research department, which would be great because then you know what insights work, what doesn't work. But I was wondering if you have an example of how people have been able to make great decisions based on data.
I mean, I pause for a moment because I do think that there are so many different examples that we could focus on. I think so one thing that also has evolved over the last several years has just been this idea that data has really become the backbone of the way that our university functions. And, you know, I haven't worked in another university with the same sort of like maturity level in terms of the analytics that are available to power our institutional research efforts. So I can't really speak to how it feels to be a part of a different team, but data is just a key part of so many strategic conversations. So a great example of that is, you know, to speak in the student space within our retention efforts, that those conversations, those working groups that are sort of cross-departmental, interdisciplinary, we have a AVP for retention initiatives, who is the primary chair for the retention working group, and that is co-chaired by one of my colleagues within the UAIR team, who serves as our student data architect. So they work hand in hand. So every single topic that arises, policy change consideration that comes into play, all of that is supported with a conversation around the data. You know, we want to do this. What does the data say? We want to do this. Is there data available to support this? Does this make sense? We work in such tight partnership, and a lot of that has come through relationship building. It wasn't always that way, but there's been a lot of inroads in terms of relationship building and us having a seat at the table and being able to make really meaningful contributions and enhance the impact of the work through our understanding of what's available and what's possible and how it fits into the bigger picture.
Is a great achievement, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of wins come out of that, of making sure that they're using the data accurately, that they're considering everything, so that they can have the knowledge that they need to make better decisions. Because it's not just data, it's knowledge. Once it has, I always tell people, data itself is just a bunch of tables or a database, but having that context from the expert. So having the expert in data that can provide you the insights, and then the expert, meaning the leader that understands the context around the data, provide that knowledge. That's when they can get to that aha moment and say, now I understand what's happening and what we need to do to make an improvement. So that's wonderful.
It sort of makes me think of this saying that you might have heard as well, where people talk about organizations or institutions being data rich and information poor. Mm-hmm. And I would say that we're data rich and information rich, but all of that still sits under this umbrella of data literacy. I mean, you can still have a lot of information available at your fingertips, but you don't understand it. It's still not going to be fully leveraged. There's a process and sort of a spectrum that exists within that.
Yeah, that's so true, because it can be data rich, information rich, but maybe knowledge poor.
Yeah. And insights. I feel like insights is another piece that that's kind of like, you know, in terms of our evolution, something that we have our eyes on of like, what does that look like? as we move forward.
Absolutely. And Ashley, before we wrap up, which all of this has been extremely insightful, do you have any advice for anyone that is looking at starting to provide more insight to faculty, leaders? And what would be some of those insights that you can share with them about data literacy and how to be user-centric as well?
Absolutely. I think one of the key things that folks would benefit from when thinking about enhancing data literacy is to start to learn about this concept called design thinking. And design thinking is essentially a way to look at projects, efforts, initiatives from the standpoint of the user, but thinking about it in an iterative way. So it's not like you create a product, you create some sort of deliverable and you never look at it again, but you really have a feedback loop between the users, the faculty, the workforce, the leaders to understand, hey, is this working? And if it is, great. If it's not, what do we need to do? And you kind of keep going through that iterative loop and development cycle until you get a place where the people that you're trying to support really do feel fully supported in the tool that you've developed for them. So I think design thinking can be a really key part of learning if that's something that you're looking to expand on.
That's a wonderful insight. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you so much for joining us today. It has been a pleasure to have you here today. Your insights and expertise were incredibly valuable and provide a lot to our listeners. It's a wealth of knowledge on the topic, so we highly appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, listeners, thank you so much for joining us today and the importance of data literacy in higher education. You can subscribe to our events by going to nflux.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, where we post announcements about our solutions and resources like today's session. I'm Alejandra Sartuche, and you have been listening to Ed Luminaries.
You've just listened to Ed Luminaries, inspiring stories and ideas from educators to educators with Alejandra Sartuche. Connect with us at edluminaries.com to join the conversation and access the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.